HRNradio.com, where positive people and podcasts unite.
Hi, everyone. This is Lionel Ketchian welcoming you to our show today. And, of course, we have Dr. Bernie Siegel with us. And in case you want to call in and be a part of the show, please, we welcome your call. It's 800-555-5453. That's 800-555-5453. So let's begin. Bernie, I guess we're going to talk, since it was Halloween yesterday, we'll talk about mystical stuff and some interesting things that I guess we don't normally talk about, right?
Yeah, and I think also if anybody has experienced something and they want to feel safe talking about it, call in.
Right.
And, you know that you're not nuts. I was just thinking, I mean, I have so many personal experiences I hope we have time to get to, but one of the things that I can remember, one of a patient of mine had a cardiac arrest, was resuscitated in the hospital, he was a diabetic who had lost his sight. And when they resuscitated him, he said, his wife and myself were standing next to his bed when all the other doctors left, and he said, I was out of my body watching everything going on. And his wife said, honey, you're blind. What are you talking about? You're nuts. I mean, stop acting crazy.
Yeah.
He said, dear, they told you to move back. You went over and sat in the corner of the room, and you're wearing a green dress.
Wow.
I thought his wife was going to faint.
Wow.
But there's a book, actually, called Mindsight, in which people born blind had near-death experience. And the one I never forget that really touched me was a man who was in an auto accident in the fall, and he said he left his body, and the beauty was incredible. All the leaves, you know, the colors. He'd never experienced it in his life because he was born blind.
Right.
And he was so upset when he didn't die because he'd never see this again.
Right.
But, you know, when people aren't afraid to share those things, it's they know the answer is going to be, oh, you're crazy, that can't happen. You know, I think back, like that neurosurgeon, I forget the name of his book, or the father who wrote a book about his child, that heaven is for real, because the neurosurgeon had a near-death experience and couldn't deny that he had it, because before he had experienced it, he was saying, oh, it has to do with brainwave activity, and the brain isn't dead, they're not, you know.
Right.
He's coming up with scientific explanations, and then it happens to him, and he writes a book. and the child, four-year-old, came back from, you know, near-death experience, was resuscitated. I think he was in the hospital, had appendicitis, a ruptured appendix or something, and started telling the father, you know, like, I met Grandpa, I met my sister, I met... And the father at first thought, honey, that's crazy, you're telling stories. But then he realized what the son was telling him, like, I met my sister. He was born after his sister had died. He never knew he had a sister. And yet he's talking about her. And so then the father ends up writing a book too. You know, Heaven is for Real.
Right.
And I have to say that some of the things that opened me up, at age four, I also, choking on a toy, had a near-death experience.
Yes.
And
right.
as most children will tell you, they were upset. And I was, when I didn't die.
You had to come back.
It was just so fascinating and interesting to be out of your body and looking. But I also had a feeling, I guess I've had an angel from day one. I think we all do.
Mm-hmm.
Because he did a Heimlich maneuver on me. The kid is dying on the bed, choking to death, which is incredibly painful. I was so happy to leave. I was upset. I can remember thinking, see, that's the other part. You leave your body and you're still thinking, you're still seeing, you don't think, how the hell is this going on?
Right.
You know, because it's your experience. And William Saroyan, the author, in the story, the young man on the flying trapeze, the trapeze to heaven, and the young man dies, and the last words in the story are, he becomes dreamless, unalive, perfect. Boy, that hit me, you know? The authors always seem to have that insight. You leave your body, you're perfect again. Yeah, you don't have a body, but everything else is functional.
You know what I find interesting, and as a doctor, you can appreciate this. As a doctor, a medical doctor, MD, you know, you're based in science. I mean, you've been
right.
You know, science is part of your vocabulary, your understanding, your reality. But yet, when you consider, you know, you've brought up the word experience a number of times already. And, you know, science tries to understand experience. It tries to factor it in, but experience is a very different reality, and it stands on its own. But yet, we always question the person having the experience, but the person who has the experience goes beyond reason and really fully right. understands that it's real, but for them, and that's the issue, because for everyone else, how does it really relate?
Yeah. I mean, Einstein sounds like you. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
He knew he was experiencing things that he couldn't explain. So he didn't mind talking about life as a miracle, you know, because you can't deny it. It's here. It's
well,
here.
I wish more scientists would talk about life as a miracle because,
yeah.
you know, then you get into the just the hard, cold nothingness
right.
of something.
The nature of creation.
Right, right, right.
But,
you know, when you started the show, there was another thing you said right in the beginning that I kind of marvel at. And you said, if you'd like to call in, just know that this is a safe place. We're not going to think you're crazy. You could talk about anything you want. You know, we don't say that enough. And you know something? I think the world's become an unsafe place in a lot of ways. And
right.
I think that that's a great statement, which we have to understand.
Yeah, we have forgotten how to listen. We keep prescribing. It's like you came into the office and I'm your doc. You say,
right.
I've got this and this. Okay, here's your pill. Goodbye.
Yep.
And maybe I should have said to you, what's going on in your life? Why, how did this come up? What's happening? And then you can look at the cause, the etiology, correct your life, and make changes. And those are things. See, one of the things, again, the safety. I've heard so many stories when participating in Compassionate Friends, parents of children who have died. They know if you're sitting in the room with other people who have had the experience, I can talk here. I remember a patient of mine coming in, because she really started me on some of this work.
Right.
She came in, name is Monica. I still know her. Still does things for me and my patient. She came into the office one day as my patient, said, you know, I've learned you're not a normal doctor. So I brought you a message. What's the message? It's from Frank. If I'd known it was this easy, I'd have bought the package a long time ago and not have resisted so much.
Right.
And I knew who he was. He was a... Matter of fact, his name was Frank Weider. He was an ophthalmologist who had died of cancer. He was part of our group. I called up his wife. I said, I don't want to upset you, but if you're willing to listen, I have a message from Frank. I said, fine, go ahead. I said, if I known it was this easy, I'd have bought the package a long time ago and not have resisted so much. Then I hear a shriek over the phone.
Really?
I said, I told you, I don't want to upset you. He said, you're not upsetting. That's what Frank said every time we left the meeting. I can't buy the package. You know? And I may say, when I say Monica is still a resource, there are people who have had their loved ones die. And I'll tell them, you want to call Monica, email her, go ahead, tell her you'd like a message. Because, again, what fascinates me, Monica did not know my parents, and really, in many ways, didn't know me. I was a doc, but my father died. And then, a couple of years later, my mother died. The phone rings. Hello, Monica. Yes, Bernie. Your parents are together again, they're proud of you, and they're being shown around by someone who likes cigarettes and chocolate. Oh, it's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. She's showing your folks around.
Wow.
Now, what blows my mind, Monica does not know my parents at all, has no, you know, information that they died, doesn't know that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross was a close friend of mine. I mean, and here, all this stuff. And not too long ago, during a stressful time, I was so damn busy knocking myself out, the phone rings again. It's Monica. Ernie, your folks are concerned about you. Take care of yourself. Now, and years ago, the only C I got in college, 4 years of college, I got one C in creative writing. I was taking
somebody didn't agree with you.
An interesting course. Well, I thought too much. You know, I'm a science major.
Yeah.
So I thought too much, and I didn't know how to write. And I would say to anybody listening, always write a letter to everyone you're writing from, and then it'll flow. But the phone rang, and Monica said, Bernie, you're going to write a book. I said, you're insane. I am not a writer. I'm an artist. I only got a C in it. Well, we're now up to 14 books. And Monica would often say, you know, another one's coming, another one's coming.
Uh-huh.
But again, what is she reading? She's reading consciousness. That never ends. Let me tell you some of the parents' stories. And one of mine, don't let me forget about a butterfly.
Okay.
This teenager had a room full of butterflies. He studied them. And, you know, all over his walls were framed like, you know, pictures, but inside under the glass were butterflies and everything else. And he died. The father said, I'm out walking the woods in Connecticut. This butterfly starts following. And it was a beautiful butterfly and just kept going with me. We went back to the house and then the butterfly left. And I went up to my son's room to look it up. And it's a butterfly that is only seen in South America. So what's it doing in Connecticut?
Visiting you.
Your daughter loves birds, and she's murdered. Her sister has an outdoor wedding. They didn't cancel. They didn't think the daughter would want them. She was murdered. So they're holding an outdoor wedding. During the procedure of the wedding, a bird lands in a tree and made so much noise that they had to stop the wedding temporarily while the bird cackled and made. Everybody there had one comment. Oh, your sister's here. Your daughter's here. No, in the tree.
Wow.
While the woman is telling this story in our support group, who flies in an open window? A bird.
Really?
Flew in. Yeah. Now, we sat in that room like 5 years. No bird even bumped into the glass, let alone fly in. And, you know, everybody in the room's reaction was, oh, your daughter's here. You know, she heard you telling the story. And another was a woman on the parkway. Her son died. He raised pigeons. She's zipping along on the parkway when she hears her son say, slow down, Mom, slow down. And a pigeon lands in her lane. So she slows down. Then comes around the curve. It was a sheet of ice. You know, the black ice kind of thing. And 20 cars were piled up. And she said, if I hadn't heard that message, I would have been in it, too. And, again, even with communicating with animals. I have a friend, Amelia Kincaid. And just so people listening to this, I don't make up any story, believe me.
Yeah.
When I had pets missing that I couldn't find, Amelia, I'm in Connecticut. While she was in California, what blew my mind, while she was in Africa, she told me where the pets were. And absolutely correct. I mean, it's amazing. I'm laughing because she said, oh, the cat must be in the garage. I said, why? She said, it's a mess, all these boxes and bags and things. I said, no, that's our basement. I mean, she described that basement so accurately. Just our five kids just left everything when they moved out, you know?
Yep.
And I laughed, but I knew the cat was in the basement because I hadn't shut the door when I went in. The cat had run in. But the details, and she would say, I'm looking through the cat's eyes, not dead.
Wow.
And one was somebody left the house door open, and this indoor cat went out. Didn't show up for a couple of weeks. But with Amelia's description, I went out and kept calling the cat's name. See, and she said something crazy. She said, the cat's under the house. Now, I thought, Amelia, you're nuts. How do you get under a house?
Right.
Well, the cat was under a stairway that came down the side of a hill from the main entrance. And
pretty
it was
good.
Protecting itself. It like put itself in a cage, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so, again, consciousness does not end when our life ends. I really feel that's what we talk about when we say past life experience, that it's not that you and I have had 12 lives, but that our consciousness has experienced other lives. So we are born, and then the information from a past life is a part of us.
You know, it's interesting that we use the terminology stream of consciousness.
Yep.
I think there's a lot of, that applies to the fact that we don't even know what consciousness is, actually, with all our science. How do we even understand what it is? We can't.
But it's never ending. You know, it is
like a stream. Right.
It flows into the, ocean.
Exactly. And replenishes.
And I think you think, whether you use the term God or not, it's a constant recycling, because the stream ends up in the ocean, the water evaporates,
it turns to rain,
back in again.
Right. I mean, that's a perfect metaphor for death, a recycling of the same thing.
Well, I have to say, see, even water is mystical.
Right.
You know why?
I do know why, because you have explained it to me. It's
okay,
the only
tell the people listening. Because, what really struck me also is in the Bible. Jesus and, Nicodemus comes to him and says, how can I be born again? I can't fit in my mother's womb. You know, I'm a grown-up. And Jesus says, we are water and spirit. And I thought, where did that come from? Why didn't he say we are earth and spirit, soil? You know, we hear that Adam was made out of the soil, so to speak.
Right.
But again, I think those are metaphors, terms that mean much more than that. He's made out of what is there, the soil of life, let's say, not just the dirt. But anyway, when I saw water and spirit, I thought, wow, what a comment. Because water defies the laws of physics. It, when frozen, I mean, think about this. You know, when a volcano erupts, you see all the hot lava running. Then it cools and becomes a rock.
Right.
And
that's the end of it.
Yeah, but water, when you cool it, becomes ice and floats. And that is the only liquid which becomes less dense when you freeze it. But when I thought about that, and you think about life, what if everything froze from the bottom up? You know, it would eliminate life.
Uh-huh.
In lakes and oceans and everywhere else.
True.
Because everything would be forced out. Instead, it ends up protecting you. And I think, I always say to people, water is a wonderful example. You know, you can be liquid, solid, vapor. So whatever you run into in life, choose which you want to be to handle that situation. You can rise above things. You can rain and, put the fire out.
That's true.
Or you can cause a flood. I mean,
right.
It isn't what you are, but how you use it. So
right.
You can be a tsunami and destroy life, or, you can be water and save life.
Yeah, absolutely. And interestingly enough, science has found that our bodies are made up predominantly of water. So
right.
When you say, for Jesus to have said, you're made of water and spirit, I mean, the whole, understand, everybody believed it was, the earth, because we were solid, so how could it be water? It doesn't seem to be making sense.
Yeah, and I'd always say also that proves God loves us.
Okay.
That because the way that life is created has built into it all these mysteries that allow us to survive. From healing a wound. I always say if you cut your finger, you don't panic and say, I'm going to bleed to death, I'm going to die of an infection. I mean, how did that get worked out, that the wound heals and you're okay?
It is pretty incredible, because when you first get injured, you think the worst. You say, how am I ever going to live with this? And
right.
If you wait long enough and you allow healing to happen and you take away all the blocks to healing, the miracle occurs. And it is miraculous, really. I had a question for you talking about all these things, but I know we're coming up to that time. Or at least we will be very shortly. So maybe I'm going to save my question for you when we return. Okay, because you brought up a point about God loves you, and I wanted to expand that and bring that into other lives and the spirit and, how you view certain things, because...
Remind me about the operating room, too.
Okay.
Some of the things I experienced there. When you think about cutting people open... and having faith that they'll be okay, put them back together.
Yeah,
all right.
That's a pretty incredible belief to have.
Yeah.
It's, thank God you had that belief, because I think it saved a lot of people.
Yeah.
Without it, you don't have that intentionality going forth to create, you know, what's good for people and what's ideal.
And, and also how our consciousness is still awake.
Like what you hear? Tell your friends. Thanks for listening to HRNRadio.com.
We're back, and just in case you want to get some information, some books, and some really interesting material, well, you could visit Dr. Bernie's website. Let me give you that website. It's BernieSiegelMD.com. That's Bernie, B-E-R-N-I-E, Siegel, S-I-E-G-E-L-M-D.com. So check that out. There's some great stuff that's available to you. So we're back, and Bernie, what I wanted to talk about, because you mentioned that God loves us, and my thought was, when we're talking about, let's say, past lives or near-death experiences or the way, you know, this reality seems to be created, whether you want to call it God or the universe, whatever you choose, you know, or
right.
You have no view on it whatsoever, I think that's true, because I think what's happening is, you know, one of the ways I look at that love is happiness. I mean, I look at the world as a possibility for us to experience happiness. I mean, I think that's what heaven is all about, and the idea of heaven is a place to be happy. And, you know, I like to think that we could create that right here where we are, take it with us when we leave, you know, maybe bring it with us when we go, you know.
Right.
But the universe, or God, or, you know, has created this idea of love, and I could throw in happiness with that as far as my own thoughts are. But is that the case? In other words, do we live in a loving universe when we experience all the things we experience in this world?
Well, the trouble is, you know, when you don't grow up with love, you don't experience a loving universe. I mean, I think we're here, literally. When somebody asked me what's the meaning of life, after going on and on and on, it suddenly hit me. The meaning of life is to make God happy. See? Now, what do I mean by God? I mean loving, intelligent, conscious energy, whatever it took to create this world, and more, you know, than our planet, but the whole universe. And so if we can make our Creator happy by the things we choose to do, that's what life is about.
You know, that's very interesting.
Yeah, because think about it. If you created everything thinking, you know, I want to do something wonderful and give people opportunity, and then you look down and you say, oh, my God, look what they're doing to each other. You know? But, again, if you grow up without the love,
yeah,
you know, which is the opposite, is indifference, rejection, abuse, et cetera, you know, and then you seek revenge and you kill people. I mean, you listen to the quotes from some of these mass murderers, you know? I mean, they're killing people. Why? Because they're not the same as they are. You know, the same religion, the same beliefs, same. So they're no good. I'll kill them.
Right.
It's just so insane. But again, see, if God made a perfect world, God would be bored. What the hell is the point of my doing this? You know, it's no fun.
Sure.
But if you don't make a perfect world, and then you see people doing something real, what I call it, you know, meaning helping the lives of others, then God can say, oh, I did something good.
Yeah, well, you're right. If God made a perfect world, we would be wind-up toys, and he would know exactly what we would do, because he would have, you know, put the instructions in there, and that would be the end of it.
Yeah.
But we have some sort of choice and freedom, and
and it makes it meaningful.
Yeah, yeah.
See,
yeah,
and
go ahead.
Also the biblical line, everything God created, God saw it was good.
Right.
It doesn't say that after God created man. And, you know, I think God had a clue. You know, I got to have something in here.
Well, I think God has a sense of humor as well, but that's
definitely
another story.
What else did I want to talk about? Oh, as a surgeon, yeah.
The thinking operating
about,
room? The operating
you know,
room?
Thinking about cutting people open.
Uh-huh. I mean,
you got to have faith. You know,
yeah,
that we're capable of healing. And the other thing, I mentioned that I got to know Elizabeth Gould Ross. I mean, you know, she was so into death and and just spirits and world and, you know, a little bit like my friend Monica talking to the dead. And, I mean, I thought all that was nuts, too.
Uh-huh.
But, again, my experience changed me. And I'm laughing because I always picture sitting in Hartford in the airport with Elizabeth. She had come to Yale to lecture. I invited her as a guest, and Yale was happy to have her back when she was famous. And so we took her back to the airport and was sitting there at a table waiting for the plane, you know, in the cafeteria. And she starts in about all these dead, you know, spirits floating around and going on. And I noticed all the people at the tables near us literally got up and moved away.
That's funny.
And I thought, they're sure we're too psychotic, you know,
right,
and could be dangerous. So I better move my table. But I started doing those things in the operating room. And again, I don't know what stories I've told or not told, but I started talking to people under anesthesia because I felt they heard me. The anesthesiologist would say to me, "What's the matter? Patient's not anesthetized well enough?" I said, "No, the anesthesia's fine. It's deep enough. So who are you talking to?" "I'm talking to the patient. She can hear me." And they'd look at me like, "Siegel, the patient's unconscious. What are you talking about?" But what they learned, too, was patients began to wake up and talk about the things that were said in the operating room, asking questions, so forth. And then the anesthesiologist would say, "What the hell did they know what we were talking about?" And it wasn't always about the patient, you know what I mean? It might have been some other interesting topic.
Right.
And the patient wakes up and said, "I didn't hear the end of that. Can you?"
Oh, that's funny.
You know,
funny. You know, in the 80s, my mother was going to have surgery in New Jersey in a hospital, and I had asked the doctor. Back then, you know, everything you were teaching back then wasn't really mainstream.
That's
so
right.
We had to watch what we were, how we put things. So I had asked the doctor, I said, "Look, when you are operating on her, I have a request." And he said, "Well, what do you want?" So I said, "Would you not say anything negative whatsoever while you're in the operating room, or ask everybody else to just keep everything positive no matter what?" And I didn't throw in I've read about Dr. Bernie Siegel's work and I didn't, because I figured that's not the thing to tell another doctor. So at the time I just said, "Look, I'm into positive thinking and I was just hoping you would abide by my wishes." And he said he would. So I was thinking, from what I learned from you back then, that you know, if you start talking about something really, let's say the doctor mentioned, "Oh, I think we're going to lose the patient," and wasn't referring to my mother, was referring to some other patient.
Right.
And then, boom, all of a sudden, the patient reacts because they're listening.
Yeah, I've seen that when surgeons would say, "This is the worst case I've ever seen in my life," you know, that particular thing.
Right.
And you could see the reaction of the patient because, again, the anesthesiologist and nurses all thought I was nuts. But they began to see the benefit. I mean, the nurses saw that my patients woke up without pain. Because I would say to them, while they're anesthetized, "You wake up comfortable, thirsty, and hungry."
Wow.
Yes, they gained weight, and I had to stop saying "you wake up hungry," you know, so that they didn't just keep eating, but to control that. But when people saw a positive result, I always say, what people experience, they can't deny. And when things began to work, nobody was against success. So if it worked, then why don't we have everybody do this? Accept it. So that was something I saw with the anesthesiologist. And then one day, we're going to take a break soon, but I'll tell you the story, part of it, before the break, was a patient's heart stopped. And the anesthesiologist was working away. It was a patient with intestinal, you know, with peritonitis, ruptured intestine. So it was not a fatal disease.
Right.
His heart stopped. The anesthesiologist was working away and finally said to me, "I can't get it started again. I'm going to get a stretcher to take him to the morgue."
Wow.
And he started towards the door. And when we come back, I'll tell you what I said to the patient.
Interesting. Interesting. Well, I'm going to stay here and tune in on that one. We'll be right back. Stay tuned.
Give yourself some love with our self-care programs at hrnradio.com.
Okay, we're back, and we welcome you back, and we're just in the middle of a story. We're going to go back to Bernie to hear the rest of the story.
Well, the operating room, you know, the nurses were helping me. There was a medical student scrubbed in. The anesthesiologist walked towards the door to the operating room to get a stretcher to take him to the morgue. And I thought, what the hell do I have to lose? You know, I'm not worried about whether people think I'm insane. So I kind of looked up a little bit and said, Brad, it's not your time yet. Come on back.
Wow.
And guess what happened?
He came back.
His heart started beating again.
Wow.
Now, you know, I didn't expect that, believe me. But I thought, what the hell do I have to lose? Elizabeth keeps telling me all these spirits are hanging around. And the anesthesiologist, I never forget his statement. He turned around and came back because the monitor went on again, you know. And he came over to me. He said, I like working with you. But what was interesting to me was the medical student. He couldn't accept it.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, his reaction was, no. That didn't happen. It wasn't because you said something. It was just not in his world. And that's the problem of medicine, I have to say, because we're not, you know, you can go to medical school for 4 years and nobody talks to you about the consciousness and near death and past lives and all kinds of things, which psychiatrists are more aware of.
Right.
Because when I would try to write articles, medical journals refused them because they weren't appropriate, and psychiatry journals refused them because they were appropriate, but they weren't interesting. You know, I mean, I found many books written by psychiatrists years ago when I was starting to think about writing my experience and realized they were writing it. You know, the will to live, you can fight for your life.
Right.
I mean, these were psychologists, psychiatrists, and I've mentioned this many times, but Carl Menninger, the psychiatrist, I sent him my first book, Love, Medicine, and Miracles. He wrote back, Bernie, I was about to write a book called 10 Hopeless Cases. 10 people are alive and well today who should be dead, but you just wrote it.
Yeah.
And what a comment from a psychiatrist, whereas if I'd speak at the conference at Yale, they'd say, oh, come on, you're blaming your patient. You know what I mean?
I know.
If you went into the life of your patient, it was guilt, shame, and blame. Oh, and you're giving false hope.
Well, that's another one.
What the hell is false hope, you know? Yeah, it's an oxymoron. There isn't any. So, yeah,
well,
I've got, matter of fact,
on
my website.
We know what false despair is.
Yeah, right. That's exactly what doctors do. See, here's the statistics. This is when you'll die. I mean, I know people, one man who died, he loved playing with his grandchildren. He loved betting on horses. He had lung cancer. He developed cataract, so he can't read the paper. He can't play with his grandchildren. So he goes to his health plan. Hey, I'd like cataract surgery. No. Why not? Oh, you'll probably be dead in 6 months. We're not spending all that money on cataract surgery. He went home and died in a week.
Wow.
And I told the family, sue them. I mean it. They killed him with their words. So I learned, and on my website, if people want to read it, deceiving people into hell. See, I was more likely to lie to you to keep you alive. Yeah, I have
That's
a wonderful treatment. Come in next week. I'll give it to you.
Yeah, but, you know, Bernie, in your book, you scientifically explained how certain drugs that might save somebody's life were put out on the market, and then the patient is taking them, all thrilled that this is going to save their life. And then they read a report in the paper that, oh, they don't think the drug is working that well.
Yeah, no,
and then
that
the patient
was,
died.
I think it was with Laetril.
Okay.
Bruno Klopfer, psychologist. Again, a psychologist. He wrote a lot about this. He had a gentleman with cancer who was part of this new study. And the guy's cancer responded beautifully. He was feeling wonderful. And then a preliminary report came out at 6 months saying it does not seem to be effective in the treatment of cancer. And the guy relapsed immediately.
Right.
So what does Popper do? What Siegel does? He lied to him. He said, oh, I just found out. They didn't have the super refined crebiazin. That's what it was. Because now I remember saying it that way. Those are his words. They didn't have the super refined crebiazin.
Wow.
Now we're getting that in.
Wow.
So you'll do fine now. And the guy responded to the new treatment. And then the final report came out at the end of the year. Crebiazin is of no use in the treatment of cancer, and the guy was dead within a couple of weeks.
Right.
See? And I've seen people who were misdiagnosed with AIDS because of an error in the lab report. They thought they were HIV positive because the doctor told them, and they were dying. And then this one that I read about, the doctor suddenly realized, oh my God, I was looking at the wrong list. He's an HIV negative. And he called him up and said, you know, I have a correction. You're HIV negative. And within 2 weeks, the guy was perfectly healthy and fine. And again, how powerful that is. And that should be told to doctors so we're taught how to talk to people. See, again, in the book Cancer Ward, the term self-induced healing is used, not spontaneous remission, but
right.
Self-induced.
I like that.
Yeah, and again, it's because Solzhenitsyn had cancer. He's the native. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So he knows, and it's coming again from his consciousness. He didn't say what doctors say. Oh, here's a, you know, that one of the men comes in and says, oh, there are cases of spontaneous remission. He said, no, it says in this book there's self-induced healing. And interestingly, it's a rainbow-colored butterfly fluttering out of the book.
Oh.
And the butterfly is transformation, the rainbow is life in order. So he has this intuitive wisdom. You see, you learn you have a life-threatening illness, get your life in order. Bring harmony and rhythm into it. Transform it. Then
you know,
the body wakes up.
You know, you talk about healing, and I'm an advocate of it. I'm in awe of what you have done, because, you know, you certainly showed us the way to healing. But one of the things I personally conceive of in my own understanding, maybe in my own consciousness, is that I look at life two ways. One, I'm here right now, so this moment is it, and I appreciate it, and I live it, and I love it. Look, I'm with you. As far as I'm concerned, this is the best time of my life. Nothing could be better than this moment for me. But I have another thought, and the other thought is that no matter what, I've got forever, but I only live it one moment at a time. So if we don't live this moment well, what does forever matter? Well, we're going to be forever miserable, or we're going to be forever happy.
Well,
we might as well do it now.
Let me explain forever for people. Because here's one of my problems. See, I mentioned to you about sitting in rooms with compassionate friends, children who have died. Like that lady who said a pigeon appeared. See, and I heard my son. I'd say to her, boy, your kid's a bum. What do you mean? Why isn't he back in another body, doing something, going to school, growing up? What the hell's he doing hanging around, you know, doing nothing,
right?
You know? And my friend, Brian Weiss, who's written about many lives,
sure,
many masters.
Sure, sure.
When I say friend, he was a student at Yale, psychiatry. And he said, oh, I like being in the operating room with you. It's not normal. You know, when we come back, let me tell you my conflict with Brian. See, because I would say to him, if a kid, you know, 7 years later shows up, where the hell's he been? Why isn't he back in school?
Yeah. How long ago was Many Lives, Many Masters written? That was a long time ago.
Yeah, that had to be close to, you know, like 80? 25 years or so.
Well, good. All right, good. So let's stay tuned, and we're going to be right back for some more good stuff. This is interesting.
Lighting the way with positive energy and love. HRNradio.com.
All right, I was going to talk about Brian Weiss.
Yes. Many lives, many masters.
Yeah, see, the thing, I mean it, that he and I would often argue about is why, you know, he doesn't judge people the way I do. That when somebody says their son showed up 5 years later, I said the kid could be in kindergarten starting a new life, so what the hell is he doing hanging around? And Brian would always say to me, Bernie, there's no time when you leave your body. Because you were talking about recycling. You're not recycling. There is no time. You're just existing. Now, body sense time. Consciousness doesn't. But I couldn't believe it from Brian. You know, he would just keep saying it to me, and I have all these examples that don't make sense. And then I'm watching the show Carousel. I love that show. Two things in it. One, a man is involved in a robbery, and he's shot and killed. And a good part of the show is being shown around by an angel, you know, like in heaven and looking back at the earth. And then one day on their journey, the angel turns to him and says, "Oh, your daughter's graduating from high school. Do you want to go and see her?" And he says, I don't know if it was high school or, you know, public school, but it's many years later from the daughter's perspective. She's graduating from school. Would you like to see her? How can she be graduating? She's a baby. And she was when he was killed. See? And the angel says this line, "There's no time up here." Now, that's Rodgers and Hammerstein. Where did they come up with that? Where did Solzhenitsyn come up with self-healing? You know, that's the part, you see, that hits home for me, that this is coming from an intuitive wisdom of creative people. They're seeing the truth because their mind is still, they're creating. There's no time up here. And, of course, the guy goes back and watches his daughter graduate. But who do you think speaks at the graduation? A doctor. And he says, you know, "I brought all of you up." I don't remember. I mean, I have it in my computer, his exact words. But, you know, and he speaks, and at the end he says, "And this song that you may remember, take with you. You walk through a storm, hold your head up high. Don't be afraid of it. At the end of the storm is a golden light. Be silver tongue. Walk on, walk on, with hope in your heart, and you'll never walk. You'll never." Boy, that touched my heart. Here's the doctor talking to everyone. And what a difference that is. But again, when that line came out, "There's no time up here," I could say to Brian, "You're right, I agree with you. I have nothing to argue about anything." And I may add, let me just say that.
Sure.
See, what changed Brian, too, was his experience. He didn't deny it. Remember, two of his patients, I think, were met in his waiting room, ended up having a past life experience and getting married. And they shared some of those things with him as a psychiatrist. And that made him begin to look into this. And Jung said a long time ago, so people understand, this is not about coincidence. There aren't any. I mean, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who was a Jungian psychiatrist too, would say to me, "Bernie, there are no coincidences." And Jung said, "The future is unconsciously prepared long in advance and therefore can be guessed by clairvoyance." So the mystics are reading our consciousness, telling us what's going to happen, and can guide you too. What job should I take? Where should I live? What should I do? And so don't be afraid to listen. Because they're reading you. But if you're willing to quiet your mind and pay attention to your dream and your drawing, because it's easier for the consciousness to speak in image. So I hear voice. That could be our next subject.
Yeah, you know, Bernie, I wanted to say to you that I agree with you totally about time. I really never talk about time. When I said now, that to me, that now is not a moment in time. It's a moment in reality. There is no time for me, actually. I've really, as a matter of fact, I don't even believe in time, because I think the only reason we understand time as it is because of its circular nature. You know, the Earth travels around the sun every 365 days. It's day and night. So because of that kind of change, we could measure what we call time. But in actuality, it's just a part of reality. Time is just made up for our own convenience, but it doesn't actually exist. And for that matter, I don't even think space exists except in our own mind.
Right.
So you get rid of those two things, and now you've got a different reality, because then you've got a reality where all of this can fit. And I can also consider that I'm not talking to Dr. Bernie Siegel, but I'm talking to myself.
That's right. What I found also fascinating is, I often say to people to get them to laugh, I say, if you don't know what time it is, how can you get older?
Yeah, that's a good one.
But what I found was that when I do something creative, that could range from operating on somebody to painting a picture, I mean, if it's something significant, you know, or working in the garden, doesn't
time,
matter.
Time stops.
Yeah. You look at your watch, say, oh, my God, yeah. I've been here 3 hours. I thought it was 15 minutes. And then physically, my comment is, well, you're only 15 minutes older.
And yeah.
When you see people who love what they're doing,
yes.
Yeah, they live a hell of a lot longer, too, because their bodies are not experiencing time the way other people are. See?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
Your mind is in a trance then, and there is no time anymore for you.
That's true. Very true. Yeah, and I think we have a misconception of time, and the other problem with time is that we think time will, you know, like we say, time heals all wounds. I think it's our mind that's not letting go of things that is the culprit, you know,
right.
Like forgiveness. So time's got nothing to do with it unless then we think. And who cares if we're getting older? That's not really the point. The point is, what's the quality of our lives now?
The way I put it is, I remember reading this somewhere, it's okay to get older as long as you don't get old.
Right, right,
those
absolutely.
Are two very different things. So, yeah, and again, this was a study that was literally done. They asked seniors how old they felt. And those who felt the youngest ended up living the longest. So you could have 100 people who are 85, and one says, I feel like I'm 90. And the other one says, I feel like I'm 55. Well, guess who's going to live longer?
Absolutely. You know what I think another key to living is? That when we stop feeling sorry for ourselves, and those who do that learn the wisdom of not being sorry, feeling sorry, they become masters, because then there's nothing that could get you down after that.
That's right. Yeah, life is an experience. I call it a labor pain. But,
yeah.
But if you see it as something that contributes to your birth and growth, then it's very different. Matter of fact, one of the poems I got from somebody who ran into cancer, who lived in Texas. He said, I grew up in Texas, where you learned about droughts and storms and, you know, all kinds of things that they have put through, tornadoes, and you learn how to ride them out.
Wow, that's great.
That's what she applied to the cancer.